Akhotra Foundation presents the Akhotra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into, well, just an extraordinary life, Dr. Edith Eva Eger.
That's right. And specifically, we're looking through the lens of her memoir, The Choice, Embrace the Possible, which came out in 2017.
It's such a powerful book. Why her story? Why now?
Well, I think Eagle's story is really quite unique because it operates on, you know, a couple of crucial levels.
Okay.
On one hand, it's absolutely this unflinching testimony of surviving Auschwitz. Just harrowing.
Right.
But then she blends that with decades of experience as a clinical psychologist. So it becomes more than just testimony. It's almost a blueprint.
A blueprint for what?
For psychological liberation, really. She doesn't just describe the trauma. She kind of illuminates the path out of it.
And that combination, that's the key, isn't it? The personal suffering fused with the clinical expertise. I mean, how does a teenage girl who goes through that forced to dance for Joseph Mengele, losing her parents, how does she not only survive but become this world-renowned healer, helping people escape the prisons they build in their own minds? It's quite the paradox.
It really is. And what's fascinating is how she uses that deepest suffering as her foundation. So our mission today, I think, is to really unpack her core idea, which she calls the choice.
Okay.
And to understand why this idea of internal choice, internal agency, isn't just, you know, a nice concept. For her, it was a survival mechanism.
Even when everything else is taken away.
Especially then, even in total powerlessness.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning then. Talk about her early life.
Right. So she was born Edith Elephant in 1927 in Kusy, which was then Czechoslovakia, later Hungary.
And the picture the sources paint is of a pretty vibrant young life.
Oh, absolutely. Middle class Jewish family. She was ambitious, passionate about ballet, gymnastics, even dreamt of the Olympics.
A performer, driven.
Definitely. But that drive, that ambition, it was shaped by a really key figure. Her mother, Ilona. As things got worse, you know, the anti-Semitic laws escalating, her mother gave her this piece of wisdom that basically became her lifeline later on.
What was it?
She told her children something like, "We don't know where we're going. We don't know what's going to happen. But no one can take away from you what you put in your own mind."
Wow. That's incredibly prescient. The seed of internal freedom right there.
Exactly. But of course, that world just gets shattered.
Yeah.
1944. She's 16. The family is deported to Auschwitz.
And the arrival. It's brutal. The selection platform, Mengele.
Instantaneous loss. The sources are clear. A Mengele's gesture, a flick of the wrist, sent her mother and father straight to the gas chambers. She's orphaned in a moment.
Unbelievable. And then almost immediately after comes this first, well, pivotal moment you mentioned.
Yes. The first real test of that internal freedom her mother talked about.
Yeah.
Hours after seeing her mother taken away, she's terrified, shaking, and she gets pushed forward. Mengele wants her to dance.
Dance for him in the barracks.
Right there. For him and the guards. This is where you could say her philosophy was really forged in that fire.
So what happens inside her head? This is the crucial part.
This is where the choice becomes real. She makes a conscious decision. She closes her eyes. And in her mind, she's not in Auschwitz anymore.
Where is she?
She transports herself.
Hmm.
Mentally. She's on stage at the Budapest Opera House. She's dancing Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet.
That's an incredible act of mental defiance.
It is. It's the crystallization of the whole idea that controlled her body, her circumstances, everything external. But her mind, her attitude, her inner world, that was still hers. Sovereign.
A silent rebellion.
A profound one. And interestingly, that performance earned her a small reward, a loaf of bread.
And she shared it, didn't she?
She did, which just underlines that even in that hell, she held on to both her internal power and her connection to others, her humanity.
Okay, so that defiance, that internal choice, it helps her survive physically.
Right.
But physical survival isn't the whole story, is it?
Not even close. That's the next major phase. Liberation comes in 1945. An American soldier finds her barely alive on a pile of corpses at Gunskirchen Lager.
Physical freedom.
Physical freedom, yes. But psychological freedom, that was a whole different battle.
Right. The sources talk about the decades after the war being a struggle.
A profound struggle. She immigrates to the U.S. in 49, gets work at a factory, learns English, raises a family. But she's carrying this immense internal weight.
What we'd now call complex PTSD.
Exactly. Stemming from that prolonged, inescapable trauma. Plus, deep survivor's guilt, emotional numbness. It nearly destroyed her marriage, her relationships. She was living in a silent prison.
But she made another choice, didn't she, later in life?
She did. A very conscious one. She rejected that suppressed life. It wasn't until her 40s, remarkably, that she decided to go back to school.
To study psychology.
Yes. Earned her doctorate. She essentially chose to take the deepest source of her pain and transform it into her professional calling.
Turning trauma into expertise.
Precisely. And this path gave her a really crucial intellectual insight, one that kind of pushes back against common wisdom.
Which is?
She argues that the old saying, time heals all wounds, is just plain false.
Really?
Yeah. She puts it starkly. Time doesn't heal. It's what you do with the time. Healing isn't passive. It requires work. Active, conscious effort. Confrontation.
Which leads us to another major turning point, right? The decision to actually go back.
Yes. Decades after the war, in the 1980s, she decides she has to return to Auschwitz.
Why? Why put herself through that?
Because she felt she couldn't truly guide her patients towards a freedom she hadn't fully claimed for herself. The past still had a hold on her, and she needed to confront it directly.
So she goes back. What happens there?
The sources describe this incredibly powerful moment. She's standing on the very selection platform where she last saw her parents.
Oh, wow.
And she allows herself finally to feel it all. The grief, the rage, the mourning.
Yeah.
And then she dances.
Dances.
Yes. But this time, not for Manjula. Not for any captor. She dances for herself.
Yeah.
Kind of silent, sacred ritual.
Of closure. Of reclaiming something.
Exactly. Self-liberation. Reclaiming her power, her narrative, right there on that spot.
And that moment, it seems to perfectly capture her core philosophy, this idea of choice.
It really does. And she clarifies it with this important distinction she makes between victimization and victimhood.
Okay, explain that.
Victimization is the event. It's what happened to you. It's objective fact. Auschwitz was victimization.
Right. Horrific fact.
But victimhood, she says, that's different. That's internal. It's a mindset you can adopt. It's choosing to let that past event define your entire present and future identity. It's optional.
That's a challenging idea because the pain is real. The hardship is real.
Absolutely. And she acknowledges that. The choice isn't about pretending the pain doesn't exist. It's about choosing your response to the pain.
And the cost of choosing victimhood.
Stagnation. Staying stuck. You become defined by what happened, maybe refusing to fully accept the reality of it. And so you let it control you forever.
Which brings us back to the prison metaphor.
Exactly. The ultimate prison isn't Auschwitz. It's the one we build in our own minds, from unprocessed trauma, from resentment, from limiting beliefs. Her famous quote sums it up. The prison is in your mind. The key is in your pocket.
But you have to choose to turn the key.
You do. No one else can do it for you.
And her own life is just this incredible testament to that. Publishing The Choice at age 90, continuing her work.
It's extraordinary. It shows that this kind of transformation, this kind of agency, it's possible at any age.
Absolutely. So, okay, stepping back from her incredible, almost unimaginable journey, what does this teach us about our own lives, our own, you know, smaller struggles and conflicts?
Well, I think her life gives us a really powerful framework for dealing with pretty much any adversity. We can boil it down to maybe three key takeaways.
All right, let's hear them.
Okay, first, there's an emotional insight. I think the most emotionally powerful lesson is about the alchemy of trauma.
Alchemy?
Yeah. The idea that our greatest wounds, the things that nearly break us, can actually become our greatest sources of wisdom, of strength, even of purpose. Mm-hmm. Eger shows us how to turn pain into purpose. That's how you move from just surviving to actually thriving.
Transforming the lead of suffering into the gold of wisdom.
You could put it that way, yes. It's an active process.
Okay, what's the second takeaway?
Second, an intellectual insight. This is the practicality of the choice framework itself. It's a tool, really.
How so?
By consciously, consistently asking yourself, okay, what can I choose in this situation? Even if the options seem tiny, you're actively redirecting your brain.
Away from despair.
Away from despair, away from helplessness, away from ruminating on what you can't control, and towards agency, towards effective action. Even if it's just choosing your attitude, it's a systematic redirection.
Makes sense. And the third?
Finally, a universal insight. And this really comes through in her ideas about forgiveness.
Ah, forgiveness. That's always a tough one.
It is. But for Eger, it's crucial for internal freedom. Forgiveness isn't about saying what the perpetrator did was okay. It's not about absolution for them at all.
What is it about then?
It's a gift you give yourself. It's self-liberation. It's choosing to let go of the poisons and base. The resentment, the rage, the desire for revenge. Because carrying that poison only keeps you locked in the past, chained to the person who hurt you.
So forgiveness is the ultimate act of turning the key in your own mental prison.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's reclaiming your energy, your narrative. Dr. Eger's legacy, really, it shows us that recovery isn't just about getting through what happened. It's about consciously, actively building what comes next. She didn't let trauma define her. She used it to qualify her to help others.
Which leaves us, the listeners, with a pretty potent question, doesn't it? The kind Eger asks her own clients. If you look honestly at your own life right now, what's the old story, the limiting belief, the sort of mental prison you might be maintaining, maybe without even realizing it? And maybe more importantly, what's one small act of choice, just one, you could make today to start, you know, dismantling that internal wall?
It's worth thinking about because, as she says, the key is in your pocket.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.